Good evening and welcome back to Ulcerative Colitis Motherhood and Me. I'm Ulcerative Colitis Mama, and tonight's episode, again, it has been quite a while since I last posted anything. I know, I'm terrible. So before I go into tonight's episode, I just want to make you guys aware that the platform which I broadcast my podcast is changing, I think, in the next few weeks. So whether that has any impact on my future podcasting, I'm not sure as yet. I'm just looking into the platform in itself and just sort of seeing what's going to change. If it's, I believe it's merging with another service, so it might be fine, it might be completely seamless, but there may be a bigger delay than usual in the near future, so just to give you a heads up. But anyway, so tonight's episode is going to be quite sort of heavily focused on mental health, as a lot of my previous podcast episodes are. This one's going to have a little bit more emphasis on that. So before I go into, you know, sort of any further detail into the podcast episode itself, as always, I just want to put a trigger warning in place. I appreciate everybody's in a different sort of stage of their recovery and their mental health. And of course, the content I discuss may, trigger some people. So I don't want to obviously have any impact, negative impact on anybody's recovery, of course. And I just want people to be made aware that, you know, there are going to be themes of grief and loss tonight, sort of themes around mental health, low self-esteem, sort of the fawn effect, the, you know, keeping yourself small kind of concept and things. So I just want people to be aware, you know, that these are the sort of themes I'll be discussing tonight. So as always, listener discretion is advised. So without further ado, I'll get started with tonight's episode. So yeah, it's a bit of a heavy one, I guess, tonight. It is probably going to feel a bit heavy. And that's mainly because I feel like I'm bottling things up again. So a big part of this podcast is a cathartic exercise for myself as well, just to kind of share my feelings with the universe and do it in a sort of a safe space, really. You know, years ago I used to keep diaries and journals, and which were great, and you know, and I still keep them. I've got sort of a massive box of them hidden in the house somewhere, and it's always good to sort of release that, those feelings, and you know, not necessarily to anybody in particular, but just to kind of get them out there, isn't it? And I'm a very firm believer in that. And but nowadays, working full time with a family and a house and a dog and everything, and just, you know, day to day life, and a lot of my job involves writing, so it's sometimes just difficult for me to actually get my ideas down on paper and start journaling and diary writing again. So this is what kind of partly how the podcast kind of came to be, really, as well as, you know, my other platforms as well. Tonight's one is probably going to be on the slightly heavier side of the mental health, mainly because I feel like I'm having a bit of a, you know, not a lull or a dip or a relapse or anything like that at all. It's just I'm very aware that I'm not 100% at the moment, and that's probably, you know, just a bunch of things, really, and they kind of all kind of collide at the same time. So you know, one good thing that I've taken from my mental health recovery, you know, from professional support and kind of my own growth, really, and my own resilience to some respect, is I've become very in tune with how I'm feeling and how the environment has an impact on me. And I don't just mean like the environment in itself, but I mean how the environment in which I'm in, the situations that I'm in, the kind of the state of play in life at the moment, and how that has an impact on my mental health and how I work through that. Because, you know, I can't, you know, I'm in a position now where, you know, I don't want to fall apart again, and I don't want to relapse in my mental health. You know, it may happen again, you know, and it's just I'm just more aware of kind of catching myself before I slip or trip or stumble again. And I've had a little a couple of knocks to my confidence this week in work, which I think has triggered it further, really. That's just made me feel a little bit angry with myself as well as sort of hurt and things. And I'm very much one for I do take things to heart. I've always been that kind of person, so it's very difficult for me to kind of, you know, untrain my brain not to be. I think that's just a part of my personality. I'm an incredibly sensitive person, which is, you know, a curse and a blessing at times, you know. And, you know, I'm very aware this time of year as well is quite a difficult time of year. It's been 2 years since my friend Ethan passed away. And, that's going to have an impact. Anniversaries are always hard, and you know, and just sort of things crop up in your sort of your timelines on social media and things, and you know, and it, I don't, you know, it's I don't want to forget, but I it's those feelings they stir up, and Ethan's loss was quite, you know, quite a, you know, difficult one, and you know, and I feel a bit of a fraud in a way, and I do mention that on my dedicated sort of podcast episode for him, which is on this platform, because I felt quite a bit of a fraud and an imposter because I felt that my grief kind of wasn't not appropriate, but it was, you know, I only met Ethan a couple of times, in the past, and you know, sort of, and that was sort of 10 years prior to him passing away. And we'd met on sort of like, you know, friends of friends who met like sort of in out, you know, in town and things when we were in our sort of mid-20s and, you know, had no responsibilities and fell out of pubs and clubs at, you know, daybreak and things. You know, so, but it, he kind of, his sort of influence, I guess, came much later on. And it was, I stumbled upon him on social media. And it was really quite weird because it was a friend I knew from school had, basically shared or, reposted, something that he'd written on social media. And it was under the sort of the handle of Grey Matter Leaks, and I recognised his name, and I thought, I mean, surely there can't be more than one person with that name, you know, locally. And it was somebody that would never have, I presume never met him, because she was in school with me, and our school was sort of, you know, almost 20 miles away from, the town in which I hung out in, and not saying that that wouldn't happen, I mean, you know, it is every possibility, but I couldn't imagine that particular friend knowing Ethan. Anyway, it transpired, you know, that he very much like me in a way, he wanted to use his experiences with his own mental health to help other people. And whereas mine was sort of kind of around sort of IBD, colitis, sort of motherhood, and you know, sort of how, you know, it was almost like a triangle really about how those three things sort of impacted my life at pretty much at the same time, and how they continued sort of for years later. And Ethan's was primarily on his mental health and his own experiences, but of there was other elements to it where he was a writer, you know, he was an amazing, absolutely eloquent writer and a musician. He was very, very gifted. And he, you know, he had such a wonderful use of prose and language when he did his writing. And I got back in touch with him. I found him online, and I just sort of, you know, sort of added him as a friend and just got chatting and just, And I just said, look, from kind of one blogger to another, I'm really, I find your writing amazing, and I said it really sort of resonates with me, and I find it really, really helpful. And he in return sort of looked into my stuff as well, which was great. And it was almost like that mutual support, which was very much, I was really, really grateful for it. And sort of Ethan's sort of journey was very, very sort of up and down, really, and he was very, very open and honest about his experience, about his journey, and it made for painful reading at times. But I felt, as somebody who wanted to support somebody that was going through something, not necessarily similar, but sort of going through a difficult time, I wanted to, to help in any way that I could. And the devastating thing was, Ethan was a few years younger than me. He, I think he was like 3, 4 years younger than me. And he'd been very honest, and he'd said that he didn't feel that he was going to live past the age of 30. And he was very open about that, and it was very, very painful to read, and I feel quite emotional thinking about it, because it's so sad. That he'd almost made a plan that he wasn't going to see his 30th birthday. And I remember he made it to his 30th birthday, and he'd made a post about it, and he said, I in all honesty, I didn't expect to be here. I think there was a lot of past trauma, a lot of sort of things going on in the background that he didn't share, that nobody pushed him for. But the crux of it was that he basically did not foresee his future beyond the age of 30. And that's quite devastating to hear such a young person, such a gifted, kind, thoughtful, selfless person, sort of have that kind of narrative about their own life. And I actually messaged him, and I still have the message because I refuse to delete it, because it's all I've got left of him, if that makes sense. And I said something to, that I'm words to the effect of, I'm really glad you're still here. And I said that I know we don't know each other that well, but your candid, honest, open, sharing your journey with strangers is completely inspirational. And I just want to say on my behalf, on my behalf, that I am so glad you're still here, Ethan, because you matter, and you still got so much of your story left to tell. And he was very grateful for that, and he said, I really cherish your friendship. That's a very kind thing to say, Lauren. And and it and those couple of messages were incredibly important to me. And he said, I'm glad that, there was something in my story that helped you. And unfortunately, he only made it to 31. And of all the goodbyes I've had to say, and there have been a few over the last few years, saying goodbye to Ethan was very, very hard. And I, th you know, and And I do feel so much for it still, even 2 years later, because although, like I said, we weren't particularly close friends, we were just two people kind of stumbling away through the dark woods by, you know, but we gave each other some torchlight. And I find that I will never forget what he did for me, how he helped me, and how he helped probably many, many other people. So it kind of goes without saying that that, of course, is going to be playing on my mind. And I try and pay that forward every single day. I try and do what I feel would make Ethan proud, that I'm not sat here being permanently upset and grieving endlessly. I feel that I can pay his kindness forward by being kind to other people and continuing that and continue what, you know, he started. So that's been quite hard, I guess. And I think because I keep myself so busy, I don't really sit around and think on things too much. I always have good, you know, I always kind of find ways to get distracted, whether it's through work or home or friends or family or something. And I never really truly sit there and think, wow, this has had quite an impact on me. And Ethan's story and his passing has a very big impact on that. Oh, sorry about that. That kind of escalated a bit quicker than I thought it would. I didn't think, you know, I thought after 2 years I'd find it a bit easier to talk about, and I think I, you know, I think I've just realized that no, I'm not quite ready to talk about it without getting emotional yet. It was just so sad, just so sad. And I think, you know, when you get your some posts on social media where you get like memories or you get sort of flashbacks, or on this day this happened, and it happened to be, you know, yesterday. It was 2 years since his funeral, so there were a lot of emotive sort of posts up 2 years ago. So it did kind of, you know, because I kind of knew it was round about this time of year, but I wasn't sure exactly on the date. So I think it hit a bit harder when I realised. And of course, it's coming up to 2 years since my dad passed away. And I know that sounds, you know, again, it's one of those you'd think I'd be even more upset, even more emotionally triggered by the passing of my dad. But that was a completely different ball game. And for those of you who haven't heard my older posts, if you're new, basically, you know, I try not to drag it up too much because I feel like I sound like a broken record and again, regurgitating old information. But basically, I've been estranged from my dad for, I had been estranged from him for about 5, 6 years. And I was off sick from work. I had COVID quite badly. And I get a phone call, sort of late one evening from my mum. And I mean, my parents split up 30 plus years ago. I was still very much, I don't think I was even 6 months old when they split up. And I've been raised by my stepdad, and I'm essentially, every sense of the word, I'm his daughter. But up until my mid to late 20s, I had some kind of relationship with my biological father. But basically, the older I got, the wiser I got to his behaviour. And he wasn't a squeaky clean person. He was quite misogynistic, he was racist, he was homophobic, he was just basically everything I don't like in a person. And he was one of these, he was a narcissist, he was very charismatic, people liked him, he had lots of friends. But as I got older, I started to see the mask slip, and I realized that he wasn't actually that good of a person. So when my son came along, obviously my priorities changed and my priorities shifted. So little G became everything. And basically the communication between me and my birth father kind of dwindled, and then from odd Christmas cards, birthday cards, to odd text messages, to absolutely nothing. And that wasn't completely one-sided. It takes, it's a two-way street, isn't it? Communication. And that was more, that was pretty much, him as well as myself. So basically my mum rang me to say she'd been out for lunch with one of her old school friends, who was obviously, bridesmaid when my parents got married. And she'd heard from her husband that she said, "Oh, I'm really sorry to hear about Lauren's dad." I'm sure, "What do you mean?" She said, "Oh, it was his funeral today." And I hadn't, it completely floored me. And as upset as I was more angry. And I think that's what, I struggle with, is that my grief has not been conventional, shall we say, because there is just so much anger. And basically, he'd passed away in hospital, I believe, on the 26th of February, 2022. And I found out that he had died on the 19th of March. And that was the day of his funeral. I had no idea. He was one of six siblings, and he also had a few nieces and nephews as well. And not one of them tried to track me down, tried to contact me. Bearing in mind, we lived in the same town. We lived in the same county, at least. I lived about 10 miles from his house. I had never, I'd never shut the door. I had always kept it ajar. I just needed time. I was going through a lot, and I didn't have time to deal with a toxic parent. My focus was on my family and my health, and he had to take a back seat for that time. And for some reason, he saw that, or the family saw that, as that I had disowned him or he had disowned me. So not only was I not informed that he had died, but I had not been made aware of his funeral. And subsequently, when I did manage to contact family members, because it's funnily enough, it's quite straightforward if they're business owners, to find their home addresses if you just know where to look online. So I have no idea how one, being a retired detective in the police, couldn't track me down. So I felt that it was very much intentional, and a very, very spiteful thing to do. So I actually wrote to him and a couple of my father's siblings, and the response was basically in terms of, "He was very proud of you as a child, but now in latter years, he felt very let down by you." And basically, "I'm the executor of his will." He's managed to, more or less, and "Don't come looking for money because there isn't any." There was never anything to do with the money. Money means nothing to me. I've always been driven by family, and that's my thought. I've always been driven that way. I'm not driven by how much I earn. I would not be working in the NHS if I was driven by money, would I? So, that was basically it. That was all I got not, I'm very sorry, we couldn't get hold of you, I'm really sorry. They couldn't even have the decency to lie to spare my feelings. It was very much, no, you let him down, so as a consequence, when he fell ill, he was never going to tell you. He, ironically, I'm not laughing, that's a very, he, the ironic thing is he actually died on the very ward where I used to work about 4 years before, 4 or 5 years before. To me, I mean, it wasn't the same ward. It had changed. The speciality had changed, but the actual ward in which she passed away was my old ward when I worked as a surgical nurse, which I just felt very ironic in a way. Quite a twist of sorts. And yeah, so that was particularly horrible. And it's something I'm probably never going to get over or accept, but I've learned that I'm never going to get the answers because the person I needed answers from is no longer here. So, I mean, to the extreme that I was actually going to consult a medium at one point. And yeah, I know it sounds really ridiculous, but I just felt that I just needed. It was the injustice of it because it was almost that I was made out to be the enemy, and the thought of people sitting there mourning for him at the funeral and wondering where his daughter was. And it was almost like that, oh, well, she couldn't even bother to turn up. I mean, basically, I couldn't have gone anyway because I was ill with COVID, and at that time, we still were having to isolate for a week. But yeah, that's probably the worst thing a parent can do to their child, to be honest. One of the worst things a parent can do to their child. And I had done nothing wrong. All I did was focus on my son, my now husband, my family, and the people that cared about me. And the door was always left open, and I would have dealt, I would have sorted something out, reconciled in some way for little G's benefit, and that would have been the only reason. And now that's happened, it's going to be a bit more difficult to explain it to little G when he's older, but at the moment he's too young to understand, so I'm not going to turn his life upside down. And I want him to be emotionally intelligent enough to understand the whole situation. Because, as far as he's aware, he's got two sets of grandparents that absolutely adore him and love him unconditionally. And that's all he needs to know at the moment. But as you can imagine, that's, almost 2 years to the day since he passed away. So that's going to stir up some feelings as well. I mean, my uncle at least had the decency to say where they were planning to bury his ashes. So when I showed my mum the letter I had from my uncle, she said, well, at least he's said, if you wanted to go and see him, or if you wanted to have some sort of, chat with your dad, in a spiritual kind of sense. And I've thought about it a lot over the last couple of years, and ahhing, but there's still so much anger there. I mean, a year ago I was having counselling through work, and that was mainly, that was a lot of things. That was workplace stress. There was a lot of things going on in my job. I'd, of course, gone through grief and anger, and I'd had my car accident. So there was a lot of raw stress, anxiety, low mood. There was a lot of stuff going on. And I mean, to be fair, the counselling did help. It was talking therapy. It was very informal. I was able to get my feelings out to somebody that was impartial, and that wasn't going to give me, oh, well, you should do this or you should do that. It was very much that they were taking it on, listening actively, and just sort of giving me suggestions on how to protect myself. And I did discuss my dad's death with her, and she said some of the techniques that I use is the empty chair. And she said I do use that when I do grief counselling with people. And she said sometimes I get them to imagine that that person that they've lost is sat in an empty chair, and I put an empty chair in the room, and I get them to talk to that chair, and as if that person was there. And I felt very disarmed by that, because I looked at the, in fact, there was an empty chair in that room at the time. And she said, if your dad was here now, sat in that chair, what would you say? And I felt so much anger burning up inside me. But it, when I get angry, I cry. And I just said, how could he have done this to me? How could he have been so cruel to his child, to his daughter? What did I do that was so wrong? And in fairness to her, she was lovely. Her name was Sarah. She said, but you haven't done anything wrong. But I'm still, 2 years later, I still haven't moved on from the anger stage. And if anybody's familiar with Kubler-Ross, the five stages of grief, it's a very interesting read. If you ever, search for it online, there's plenty of reference to it. I actually, in fact, studied and used a lot of it in my university work. She, Kubler-Ross, sort of said there were five stages to grief, and they were interchangeable, so they weren't necessarily a cycle, like a process or a cycle, but grief itself is a process. So she said, people feel anger, denial, bargaining, and depression and acceptance. But she said they don't necessarily move in that sort of order. They can sort of interchange, and people undulate, and people kind of go backwards and forwards in their grief. In my mind, I've not gone past anger, because I can't forgive him for what he's done. And that might be not, that might not be a very good means for myself to process and move on. I mean, in every sense of the word, I've moved on, because there's nothing else I can do, and I'm never going to get the answers that I need to move on in a conventional grieving sense. But I do still feel a lot of anger there. So I'm just very aware. I haven't hit a blip or a relapse or anything. I'm just very aware, particularly this time of year, how things can kind of come back and, affect me, and how I'm, and I'm still very much feeling the new job blues still. Just little things, and I know I don't help myself, because I'm not particularly social at the moment. And winter, I'm not a very social person in the winter anyway. And I do feel that, I know I said I wouldn't really talk about my new job so much, but it has been a massive impact on my life, particularly going from somewhere that kept me quite protected for 6 years. And I had some, very close friends in that job, to going to a job where I'm quite isolated, and I'm struggling with that a little bit. But I'm pushing through it, because this job is going to be such a good move for me. The sky's the limit, essentially. And already I'm seeing kind of good things happening, positive changes happening. Having said that, I've had a couple of not so nice experiences. Now, with this new job, I was very much going to start afresh. I was going to develop a new, like, be a new person and, obviously still be me, but be a little bit more confident because I earned that. I interviewed for that role. It's, it was one job, that for one post, and I got the job. So I earned that on my own merit. So and I try and remind myself every day that I deserve to be here because I interviewed for it. I did the research. I know what I'm talking about, and I'm doing the job, and I'm doing the job well. I like to think. I've not been told otherwise. And I'm being really well supported in that job. I have got a lot of support. But I've always been, and I admit it, I've always been a people pleaser. I've always done things to keep status quo, to keep everything, no confrontation, no conflict, just keep things moving along nicely without any drama. I've always done that, and sometimes I've kind of gone against some of my own principles to do it, but not in a dangerous or like illegal capacity, but I've always been a people pleaser, and that has been my blessing and curse at the same time. And sometimes I'm okay with it because I just think, look, this is just what I am. I'm just a very kind of person-centered kind of person. And I don't like conflict, and I don't like I don't like it when things go wrong and things like that. So, and I think that's probably stemmed from my childhood, and keeping myself small and trying not to be a nuisance. That's kind of basically my personality. Just keeping myself small and out of the way so I don't cause any trouble. Or I cause the least nuisance to people. And for the best part, this new job's worked out great. It has given me a newfound confidence. It's given me the ability to talk to people I probably wouldn't talk to normally. So I'm talking to surgeons and doctors, and I'm talking to them as equals. I'm not like, oh, meek and mild as much anymore, because I feel like, no, I'm here. They've asked me to see their patient. I'm seeing their patient, and they want my professional opinion on that patient, and I'm going to give it. So I feel very confident in that sense. And there's a lot of things in the pipeline. I'm actually going to be teaching in a couple of weeks. I'm actually really bricking it, to be honest. But basically, it's just so happens that I'm going to be teaching to an audience of junior doctors in a couple of weeks. And I feel very empowered by it, but I feel incredibly nervous. But I feel very empowered because that's not an opportunity I've ever had before. And I've always liked teaching, and I've always liked imparting wisdom on people, and things like that. That's why I liked being a clinical practice mentor, because I loved having students. So like I said, 9 times out of 10, it works well within this job. I feel that I speak to people on a mutual, respectful level. So, and generally people are kind to me, and therefore I'm kind to them back. But I'm generally a kind person. And I will not go out of my way to make somebody look stupid, because that's not what I'm about. I don't do that. Even if I don't like that person, I don't believe in humiliating people, because I've been in that position as a student nurse and as a junior staff nurse, where I have been humiliated by more experienced or older staff, and it's awful. It's actually quite soul destroying. And I always vowed when I became, a qualified nurse and a clinical practice mentor, that I would never treat students or anybody or any of my colleagues that way, because first of all, it's not how people learn. And second of all, you know, it is a form of bullying and I don't like it. I don't like it at all. So I've always maintained that credo of, like, we're all professionals here. We're all here for the same purpose. We're here to look after sick people. And I will always give you kindness. If you are nasty to me, I will hold my own, but I won't be nasty to you back. I will rise above it. And that's always what I've always kind of maintained to do that. However, for some reason, twice this week, I felt quite hurt by how I've been spoken to. And I don't know whether it's because I'm feeling particularly sensitive because of this particular time of year, or whether it's just because I haven't been feeling particularly well this week. I've been struggling with headaches and things, and I've got a bit of plantar fasciitis at the moment, which, when you're spending, you know, most of the time walking up and down hospital corridors, you kind of become very aware of it. But, and you know, and I had a hell of a migraine earlier this week, so you know, I haven't felt my best. But anyway, that's beside the point. So the first time it happened, I went to a ward where an agency nurse asked me to review one of their patients. So I did, gratefully, you know, gladly. I did what I needed to do. And the agency nurse brought to my attention that there was an error on the prescription chart, which, to be honest, I hadn't even noticed at the first instance. So while I said, "Oh, no, that's not right." Not like at her, because obviously she doesn't prescribe, but I just sort of said, "Oh, no, that's not right. I don't know why they've written it like that." And she looked at me, and I can't, you know, this is a podcast, I can't show you the facial expression she gave me. But if I could say, she gave me like the, you know, Martin Scorsese kind of, no, not Martin Scorsese, who am I thinking of? Stanley Kubrick, that's who I'm thinking of. Totally two different people. Stare. But you know, when people stare at you like a parent or a grandparent stares over their glasses at you, they look down their nose and over their glasses at you. She looked at me square in the eyes and she said, "If you would let me finish speaking, please." And I was, or she said something like, "Will you let me finish talking, please?" And I was gobsmacked because I don't interrupt people. The only time I ever interrupt people is if I get super excited, and I'm with somebody who's equally excited about something, and we kind of end up kind of interrupting each other because we're just so excited. And it's generally around my friends that are a little bit neurodivergent, because we just have so much to say, and we have to say it like how I'm talking now, like in a really, really animated tone. And that's not a rudeness, that's just equal kind of excitement. However, I, as a rule, I don't interrupt people because I've been brought up not to do that. And if anything, she interrupted me, so I just kind of looked at her back. I didn't know how to respond because there was a patient in their bed, sort of staring at the both of us. And I just felt, well, I felt embarrassed for a start because that there was no need for that. There was absolutely no need. So I kind of may have muttered a few expletives when I returned to my office later on. But I kind of brushed it off as, look, she, you know, she's probably stressed out. She's, you know, she doesn't know any of these patients, you know, just kind of, but I felt it was very intentional. It wasn't just like she snapped. It was like the sass she put behind it. It was almost like she was trying to make a point. She was marking her territory. She was telling me, "I know more than you. I've been a nurse longer than you. I'm older than you. Therefore, you little whippersnapper in your specialist uniform, you know, don't give me, you know, attitude." And I don't give attitude at all. So that kind of played on my mind a little bit, and I thought, do you know what? She, look, you know, just chill. She's an agency nurse. She's probably stressed as hell, and it wasn't personal. Just let it go. It's forgotten about. And it was, you know, and I, as much as I was a little bit annoyed about it because I just felt that she was wrong, but never mind. So the following day, I'd popped somewhere to. I've always been told, if you run out of a certain thing, you go here and get it from here. So that's what I did. I went to the place, and I spoke to one of the nurses there. He said, "Yeah, that's fine. You just need to go and get the keys from the office." So one of his colleagues came with me to the office, and in the office was a very experienced, very old school sister. I don't know if she's actually above him or the same level as him, because the guy I spoke to was also a charge nurse. So, I thought, well, if he says that's okay, then, great. Again, she didn't shout, and this is what made it more humiliating and more upsetting, was she smiled. And I don't know how you would describe this, but she smiled and she was very calm and pleasant. No, she wasn't pleasant. She had the calm demeanor. She smiled, and she said to me, "Since when is my department a store?" And I said, "Oh, well, I've been told that to come here if I need to." And she said, "No, you go to pharmacy to get that. My department is not a storeroom for your use," or words to that effect. I just remember I could have got away with how sort of my expression had I not gone bright red, because I flush so much more now. It's probably because of my age, but I just felt so, my face was burning with embarrassment, and I felt like I'd been told off by a parent. In fact, no, because my mum would never speak to me like that. And I said, "Oh, well, I'm sorry, but so and so who I work with said to always come here." I said, "I'm sorry if I've got that wrong." "Well, it's coming out of our budget. Why can't the ward order it in?" I said, I don't know, but I will feed that back, All the while I'm thinking, the patient I needs this medication now because this patient's in pain, but here we are having a pissing contest about who pays for what. If anything, it sounded like I was trying to take money out of her purse. So I said, "No, I appreciate that." I said, "Normally some wards do stock this particular medication, but unfortunately this ward doesn't, and I don't really know why." And I'm trying to kind of diffuse the situation by going, almost acting like I'm an idiot, because I don't mean any threat to her. I just want this situation to be over. I want to leave this situation that I'm in. And she said, "No, well, maybe you should go to the other wards then and get it from there, because they're all on the same budget." Actually, they're not, but I wasn't prepared to say that to her, was I? She said, "I will let you have it this once, but next time get it from pharmacy." So I was like, "Yes, of course. Sorry, sister. Yes, sister." And anyway, I walked back with this other nurse, the one that sort of took me there. And I felt mortified. I was sweating. I was bright red. And I felt like I wanted to cry, because I felt like I'd just been completely humiliated, because there was a third person there as well who was seeing this happen. And I felt like I couldn't speak up for myself. And I felt so angry with myself for being such a coward. But I've always been told to respect my elders. I think if this had been a supermarket situation, I would have given a what for, because I would have thought, well, actually, But again, it's that hierarchy in the NHS, you see, because she was an old school sister, she already has kind of power, you see. And they have a particular stronger sense of power because they've been there for so long. So anyway, I did get the medication and my patient was successfully treated. But as this other nurse took me back to the cupboard to get the medication from, She actually said, "I'm really sorry about that." And I said, "No, don't worry about it." I said, "You've not got anything to be sorry about." And I said, "Look, I've always been told to come here. My colleagues come here all the time to get the medication." So anyway, I shrugged it off, went and did my job like a good little nurse. And I went back to the office and I told my colleague, and he just sort of said, "Three guesses who that was." And I said, "Yeah, but I said, with respect, and my colleagues are older than me. They're about 25 years older than me, both of them. So they're, kind of like my parents' age." And I said, "I bet she wouldn't have said that to you, though." And he said, "Oh, don't stress about it. Don't let her get to you. She's like that." And I said, why do people have to accept people's bad behavior? I don't get that. That it's, oh, that's just how they are. Oh, they've always been like that. They're not going to change. Well, they should. They shouldn't be in healthcare if they're going to speak to people like that." I was humiliated. And I always smile, like, if I've seen this sister before, and I just feel that, and I could be a little bit paranoid, I guess, and I overthink things. So I already make up, stories in my head about certain situations anyway. But like, I've always made a point, if I pass people on the corridor and I recognize them, and if they're looking in my general direction, I will smile and say hi, because that's how I've been brought up. And it's a big hospital, so you get to know people's faces. And regardless of what uniform they wear, or if they're a doctor or a reporter or a cleaner or a healthcare worker or a nurse or anything, I always say hello and I smile, go, "Hi, are you okay?" If I know them, I say, "Hi, how are you? How's things? Blah blah blah." I have a little bit more of a conversation, but generally I'll sort of look at them, smile, and carry on walking. And I've done that with her, and she sort of looks at me with like derision, and I was like, I don't know what I've done to her. And she gets on with my other two colleagues, so I don't know why she felt the need to be such a cow with me. And the only thing I can think of is this queen bee syndrome. Now, I don't know if anybody listening knows about sort of female-dominated workplaces, but in the NHS, and I've always experienced this, and I've worked in two big hospitals since, I started my training to now. And I've also worked in community area. I worked in quite well, I've worked everywhere, to be honest. But now, I was always warned about queen bee syndrome, and it is basically, and it's generally with, and I'm not being ageist or anything, this is just, but particularly with a certain generation of nurses, and these are the ones that are coming up to retirement. Most of them are already gone. But these are the degree nurses. These were the ones that trained on the wards, the traditional nurses. These are the state enrolled, state registered nurses that, and I have got nothing against that at all. They were, they were the salt of the earth. These were like nurses, these knew their stuff. And they were immensely compassionate people. However, when graduate nursing came in, so when pre-registration nursing came in, I was sort of I kind of guess about 6 7 years into the degree generation of nurses. I think it started around about 1999, 2000, that your degree students started coming through the system. And these traditionally trained on the job, hands-on vocational nurses really were dead against it. They felt very, they didn't see why we needed degrees. They didn't see, why we needed to be in the classroom for 50% of the time and on placement for the other 50%. I don't make up the rule. I didn't decide. I came into nursing at that point, so I could only get into nursing if I did a degree. That's the only way, and that's pretty much still the case. One way or another. And so it's not my fault they changed nurse education. It's not my fault that they made me undertake a 3-year degree, which I, got, luckily for me, I got paid to do it in, I got a monthly bursary which paid my rent and fed me. Whereas, students now don't get paid, but that's by the by. So, I didn't ask to, I knew the only way I could be a nurse was by doing the degree to become a nurse. There was no other way around it. So it's not my fault. But yeah, we used to get, oh, I don't know why you need degrees because you're too posh to wash and all this. Not me personally, but some of my fellow students had this where you're too posh to wash. I said, well, actually, no, because the actual part of nursing I like doing is the hands-on caring side and not the bureaucratic crappy side that none of us want to do. Anyway, this has happened, I've seen this happen so many times, and I think a lot of it is that I'm a nurse of a younger age that's learning advanced skills, that's doing the, and it's almost like I need putting in my place, which I have never done. As a nurse, I have never ever done that to anyone. Student, cadet, nurse, none of them, because I don't think that's right. I think that's nasty. And nursing's changing again now. The next generation of nurses coming through are going to be more skilled than I was leaving university. But it's a good thing. It's positive because it means it's better for patients. It's no skin off my nose if a nurse can come out of university now being able to cannulate, do bloods and ECGs, because that's great, that's good on them, I've got no issue with that at all. It isn't a problem, but this is the kind of attitude they get. So my beef, if you like, with her is that she's not threatened by me, because I'm not a threat to anybody. But she felt that she had to put me in my place as the young little whippersnapper, the baby, the little girl in the specialist uniform pretending to be a specialist nurse, when I've worked my backside off to get in that position, not to be spoken to like that. And I'm angry with myself for not sticking up for myself, but there are certain people in this line of work that you can't stick up for yourself with. It's almost like there's an written rule there that you can't challenge these people because they've been there since the dawn of time, since they're older than God's dog, and second of all, that they could make life very difficult for you, and I don't want my life to be difficult. I just resign the fact that I'm still going to be there in 20, 30 years' time, hopefully not 30 years, I'd like to finish before then. And she'll be long gone. So I'm the future. And there's a lot of nurses behind me, a lot less experienced nurses coming up behind me now that are going to be my future. So, I don't know why she needed to be so nasty about it. But it really did have an impact on me where I was preparing the medication in the ward, and I could feel tears in my eyes. And I thought, no, I'm not giving her the satisfaction that she's upset me. But I did make my colleague feel, I did make my feelings known, my colleague, because I'm not putting up with that again. That's bullying. I think there's a policy in my workplace, and I remember reading it cover to cover once, because you never know. I'm very sad like that. And one of the things was harassment and bullying is classed as bullet point, making your colleague feel something like humiliated, or by making them feel stupid, or words to that effect. And she made me feel humiliated and stupid. And the fact was, if she'd shouted at me, I think I could have taken it a bit, because it was almost like this, like an emotional response to it. And I think, oh, she's probably a bit stressed or whatever, because it is a stressful job, nursing, and people do get on your nerves. And I obviously got on her nerves by asking her for medication to help my patient that was in a lot of pain. Never mind. And I was following orders from my own service. So, what are you going to do? Anyway, the fact was she did this smiling assassin kind of, she smiled, she talked calmly, but every word was kind of poison. And I felt that that was even nastier because that there was no need for that. And it was like the implication that I was actually like robbing her department. And then part of me thought, well, when the doctors come at night to administer the same medication, they must come to this department because where else would they get the medication from? And I thought, no, don't, Lauren, don't do it. Just keep your mouth shut. But sometimes I get angry because I keep my mouth shut. Because I thought there was no need for her to behave that way. So that's had a bit of an impact on my confidence this week. And I'm hoping, I the kind of interactions I have with her are minimal. But yeah, it was really unnecessary. So I read somewhere on social media quite a while ago about, around people being empaths or empathetic people. And that's something I've always considered myself to be, where they say you're very in tune with other people's feelings and you pick up on very minuscule atmospheric changes in people that you know by the way they breathe or the way they carry themselves that they're not right, there's something not right. I've always been very in tune with people, particularly people I'm close with. And that stems from a very young age where I've had to deal with a mentally ill parent, where you're very self-aware of how much noise you're making, how much space you're taking up, how much mess you're making, because you don't want to upset that parent, because you already sense there's an atmosphere. And even things like you want to make sure you've emptied the dishwasher because you know that that atmosphere is not good and you know that you're going to get told off or you're going to get the look or you're going to get sort of, admonished for that. And I've carried that all my life. And I don't think it's ever something I'm going to get rid of. I'm always going to be very highly, hypervigilant, highly tuned to other people's thoughts, feelings, and emotions. It's not something I'm going to ever get rid of. I can use it to my advantage in my job, and being an empath is not a bad thing. It makes you a better listener. It makes you very aware of how people are feeling. It's very, very beneficial in a role like nursing because you are very much, in that the very forefront of looking after people and being aware of their emotions and feelings and but it's also a curse in some senses because it makes you feel that you're the problem. I don't think it's across the board, but I do think I did listen to a guy on social media who went into quite depth and it really, really resonated with me because he said, most of your life you've tried to make yourself small, you've tried to make yourself take up as little space as possible because you don't want to be a nuisance, you don't want to get in the way. And that's always been me. That's probably why I've been a yes person, why I've always been very kind of people, like a people pleaser, because I've always wanted to make sure that I don't upset the atmosphere and I don't trigger anybody's emotions negatively, or I don't get shouted at, or I don't get looked at a certain way, or I don't get chastised for something that I haven't done. And even as almost 37 years old, I still feel that horrible feeling, and it's almost like in your pit of your stomach where you pick up on this is not a good vibe I'm getting from this person. This is a very bad vibe I'm getting from this person, and my presence is making their vibe worse, so I need to remove myself from the situation, or I need to appease them with something to make the atmosphere better. And it is, it's horrible. And sort of with that incident with that older sister, whose apparently department I was robbing, although she didn't raise a voice to me, and it wasn't even her tone of voice, it was how she influenced the atmosphere in the room, and she made it very unpleasant for me. And for that split second, I always revert back. It's almost when I am in that situation, I revert back to 8-year-old me, where I wanted to take up little space because I knew I was going to get in trouble and I was going to get shouted at, and I started feeling like fear, that I was getting frightened, and I wanted to remove myself from that situation. And it's almost like an automatic thing. If I'm shouted at, if I'm belittled, if I'm made to feel like I'm in trouble, I get upset, I get very emotional. And it's happened quite a few times over the course of the last few years, particularly because I've always been emotionally vulnerable state at the time. And the last time I felt like this was where my former manager took me to one side and chastised me for something that I hadn't done. And in fact, I'd actually tried to rectify the situation, and it was a mistake my colleague had made. Whereas I tried to rectify it, but yet I got the blame for it because I wasn't willing to throw my colleague under the bus because I didn't feel that that was fair. I just said, this is what I've done. I was told not to do this. So-and-so did this, but maybe filled it in wrong. So I went and rectified the situation. And I got really upset because I felt it was really unfair of my manager to make the assumption that it was my fault. And when I got upset, and she almost kind of got impatient with me because she was used to me having these emotional outbursts. It wasn't even an outburst. I was upset because I felt like I'd been pulled up for something that wasn't actually my fault, which is true. It was frustration, I think, as well. It was frustration, and I was feeling vulnerable, and I had nobody to back me up. And when I actually explained it to her, I think she realised then, and she backpedaled a little bit. I didn't get an apology because I never did. I never, in situations like that, nobody's ever apologised for knee-jerk reacting to certain things. And it's always me that gets hurt. And I always crave to be more emotionally resilient. But then I think, and again, looking at sort of posts on social media and things where people have shared views, you know, or professional people working in sort of, you know, counselling roles and therapist roles, sort of said, but it shouldn't be people like me having to accommodate my fear. It should be those people for not being arseholes to begin with. And it's their reaction, not your action. And, you know, and it is, I get that, and it is true. It's how people react to certain things. And my response is always to get emotional because it triggers me. It triggers things from my past, and having to deal with a very emotionally unstable parent who was very, very volatile with even the smallest things. I remember as a child being blamed for something and I didn't even do it, and he didn't believe me. And that was so horrible. And it was over something really minor. It was something really stupid, like I don't know, using the last slice of bread or something. Something really, really, really pathetic like that. And I remember being accused of it, and I swore blind that it wasn't me. And I remember getting nervous, and when I used to get nervous, I used to laugh. And I see it now because my son does it when he's nervous. He starts like having like a involuntary laugh. It is not like, and he didn't believe me, and it was so horrible. And that was my own dad, you know, not my birth dad. Christ, it wasn't him. He never fought my corner anyway. But when I had my dad, and he was in those throes of depression, and it wasn't him. He was like a different person. It was like Jekyll and Hyde. And he didn't believe me, and that really, really hurt. And it's almost like I get that now and again, and I got that with my old manager, where I was telling the truth, and I don't lie. I don't lie. I can't lie. I'm really bad at it. It's probably the empath thing, you know. But when you're, telling the absolute truth and people don't believe you, it's horrible. It's really horrible. And that's why I think I get like these emotional reactions to things, because I'm still an 8-year-old girl in those moments where I'm being chastised and treated like a child, that I respond like a child. And it's really hard to get out of those behaviours. And I have no idea how I would do that. I guess because I can't punch people in the face, but you know. It was really quite, it has, you know, and I know it sounds really silly because she's not actually done anything nasty. She just wasn't particularly kind about it. I'm going to talk to my other colleague about it on Monday, because I just don't feel happy about that. And I feel that I was singled out, because I bet your bottom dollar that when they've gone there to get the medication, my two senior colleagues that have been there donkey's years, I bet nobody's ever questioned them or told them that, oh, it's not coming out of our budget, blah, blah, blah. That's where I've been instructed to go, because if I'm in a really serious situation where this patient needs his medication and the ward don't have it, I'm really stuck. Because if I'm going to have that attitude from a department that has this medication on hand ready, and they're not willing to give it me, what, who's saying the other wards that may stock it will? And yeah, it's really frustrating, because I do think it's an age thing. And I think it's, they look at me and they go, oh, look at this, like I said, little girl in a pretending to be a specialist nurse. And it is, it just in it invokes that, those helplessness feelings that I get. And I hate it. I hate having these feelings. I wish I could not care and speak my mind, but I can't, because I've been so hammered down from a very young age that I don't know how to respond to people properly. Because I mean, you know, I had a bit of a non-traditional, unorthodox upbringing, I guess, in some respects, because I had to deal with being picked on at school by people my age, you know, by my peers. I come home and I get picked on by a grown-ass adult, you know, because my presence was too much of a nuisance. It's awful, isn't it? Because I don't hold it against my dad at all, because he was mentally ill. It's not his fault. It was all the medication he was on. It was all the, you know, they didn't have talking therapy back then. They didn't have, you know, any kind of support like that. He was just kind of left to it. And that was, you know, by his defense was, you know, his kind of, I don't know, I guess his way to make himself feel better is making other people feel bad. I don't know. I don't know. And he would be absolutely mortified if he knew how much of an impact it had had on my life. and it's not his fault, and I don't hold it against him, but unfortunately this is what, you know, you don't realize how impressionable children are until you are nearly a 37-year-old adult and you still cry when people shout at you. It's madness, isn't it? Absolute madness. So this week has been a bit of a roller coaster, shall we say. And I am in, Big G's away this weekend. He's gone up climbing Munros in Scotland. Which is, you know, great for him because he's loving life. But I think I'm just feeling a little bit isolated, I guess. And I do keep myself busy and stuff. And, you know, I've got little G here and the dog who's snoring next to me. And, you know, I do, you know, and I've taken up reading again because I love reading and it just takes me to another, you know, it sort of gives me some escapism, and I've got things looking forward to. I've got a new tattoo booked in. I've got, you know, and I want to kind of give a shout out to this tattooist because I think he's fab. I've never been tattooed with by him before, so this is going to be my first tattoo with him. But he's a massive, massive advocate of mental health, and I think it's marvelous what him and his team do. So, you know, they invest a lot of their time in supporting people with mental health issues, and I think that's really, really good. And they've gone out of their way to make their studio a safe space for people that they can express themselves freely, and you know, and that's what it should be about. I think it's absolutely marvelous, and I think they're actually looking at making a documentary about the impact, you know, the studio have on sort of promoting mental wellness and mental well-being, and I think, you know, brilliant. So there's some positive coming out of my my podcast episode tonight. But I think it is. I'm just having a little bit of a sad few days, but I'm not sad all the time. I'm just they're just quiet, thoughtful days, and I think the fact that it's this particular time of year is just making me a little bit more vulnerable than I normally am, I guess. My arm is a little bit more weakened this week. And you know, it's like my work bestie's birthday today, and I feel bad because I got invited, you know, in fair dues, I still get invited to things on a night out, and initially it was going to be like a big city night out. And at the moment, I can't really afford it because I've got a big holiday coming up and things. I've got things that need doing, and I'm not a big fan of the big city kind of nights out because I worry how I'm going to get home. And you know, with everything going on in the media at the moment, big cities aren't really safe places to be. And I'm very much a home bird. I like to be, you know, just stick me in a local pub anytime. I'm quite happy propping a bar up in a local pub. As long as I know I can get home. And so I turned it down, and then they since changed the plans and they're actually out a little bit more locally tonight. I mean, I couldn't have gone anyway because Big G's not here. So I feel a bit bad, and there's a part of me, I guess, because my job's been filled, my old job, and I mean, I've got nothing against the girl that's replaced me because, you know, she's probably a really nice girl, you know, but there's a little bit of, I feel that I've been replaced, and I just feel like I'm not part of it anymore. And I think that was another reason I didn't want to go, because I didn't want to kind of come face to face with my replacement, you know? And she's very, very confident, I guess, from what I've heard, you know. And I don't mean that as an insult. That's, you know, that's good on her. She's a very confident person. I'd love to be a confident person. I'm just not. So I did. I think I just kind of bowed out of that one. And they've got another night out coming up in April, and I won't be able to make that one either because it's, again, it's a big city thing, and they're doing like a, It, I can't remember what it's called, but it's got something with male strippers involved or firemen or something, and I just, it's not really my scene. It's not, again, just stick me in a pub or a restaurant, I'm more than happy, or go day drinking, I'm happy going day drinking, as long as I know I can get a bus or a taxi home, I'm okay. I don't like being stuck stranded anywhere. But it, yeah, that ain't my scene, seeing loads of, you know, gyrating naked men or whatever. It's just, you know, not my thing at all. But, and then I feel guilty because I've turned it down, and then I feel like I'm just like a boring git because I don't want to go to these things. And then I worry that I'm not going to get invited to things anymore because I'm going to keep turning them down. And, you know, so I am feeling a bit like worried that I'm cutting my nose off to spite my face. So yeah, I'm just feeling a little bit kind of lonely, I guess. You know, I could have, you know, I've met up with an old friend today, which is quite nice. And had a bit of a catch up with her, so that was good. That kind of boosted me quite a bit. But I just feel a bit down in the dumps, I guess, but not in a prolonged state. Hopefully not. And just things like I'm really, really trying to keep an eye on, you know, my fitness and, you know, nutrition and things, because I've got this big holiday coming up and I don't want to put weight back on. And so I'm just feeling like, you know, as a general, you know, holistic point, I'm not in a good place. I'm just having a bit of a dwindling bit, to be honest. And you know, I'll feel probably a little bit more happier on Monday when I'm at work with my, you know, female colleague, because I feel like I've got a bit of a closer bond with her. And I think it's probably because we're both women and we're quite similar in some respects. But she's kind of where I want to be, where she's very, very sensitive in terms of she's very in tune, she's very compassionate, but she doesn't suffer fools gladly. And she's very direct, but in a polite way. And I kind of aspire to be like that. But, you know, I just, yeah, I'm just feeling a little bit kind of lost at the moment, and I'm hoping it's just a temporary thing. I just get these kind of anniversary dates kind of out of the way, and move past those and just sort of focus on other things, on more positive things coming up in the future, and try not to worry so much. So yeah, that's where I'm at the moment. So I'm sorry I wittered on yet again for probably the best part of an hour. But it, like I said, I feel better by talking about it. And I know, you know, whether this episode gets out to, you know, one person somewhere in the world or a handful of people in the world, I really, really appreciate everybody who listens to my podcast or follows me on my other social media platforms. I know I'm a little bit absent from them at the moment. You know, but I am going to try and sort of update them a little bit and sort of keep, you know, keep things going. As to my platform, I don't really know, but if it's a case of it's merging with another firm, then I think I'll just have to figure out how to do that. But I will, as long as I've got a podcast to platform on, that doesn't make sense. A platform to podcast on. You know, I will keep, you know, think as long as there's even like just, you know, somebody out there in the world listening to me rambling on about strange self-pitying things like I have done tonight. But you know, like I said, I owe it to Ethan to pay things forward, and if there's anything that I've shared that resonates with other people and it somehow helps somebody else somewhere in the world, then I've paid that forward for Ethan, and I owe it to him. And I've even, that aside, you know, that's the whole ethos of why I set up my ulcerative colitis motherhood and me platforms. So, on that note, I am going to bid you good night because, I'm appreciate it's, 11:30 here in the UK at night time. And, I've got stuff to do. And but as always, keep talking, write things down. There's loads of like these well-being notebooks and things you can get nowadays that you can sort of express how you're feeling. You can keep that somewhere in a safe space and you never have to read it. It's just something to get your thoughts out of your head, and it helps process things, I find. And or podcasting or doing recordings or vlogs or doing like typing stuff up on the computer, and you can password protect it so nobody else can read it, and you can just put things down just to get things out of your head, talk to people that you trust. There's always somebody out there that's willing to listen, and I think that's very important nowadays to to talk about these feelings. And when you're feeling when you're not in a good place, it's always a problem shared is a problem halved. And don't ever feel that you're being a nuisance. Don't ever worry about that. You just look after your well-being and be in tune with yourself and be aware of how you're feeling, and and speak to somebody professional if you're not, if you are worried. There is always somebody out there willing to listen. There's so many charities out there that are, that are help, they're trained to look, to help people with their mental well-being. So, please, there are people out there that will listen. As always, stay safe, keep talking. Let's break down the stigma of mental health. And I will speak to you soon. Good night.